The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 138.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's one of my good buddies. I always look forward to talking with him. He really needs no introduction. His name is Luke Grohman. We all know who he is. Luke, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks for having me back on, George. Great to be here again.
All right. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on. I think I interviewed you about 2 months ago. So for my viewers, let's just get an update on how you're seeing equities, the bond markets, gold, Bitcoin, et cetera.
Yeah, so 2 months ago, we were still seeing basically a situation where the Fed was doing what we've called enough, you know, quote unquote enough, in terms of the liquidity being supplied into the system. And in particular, the level of bond buying relative to the level of bond supply increase coming out of the U.S. government, treasury issuance. And so it was, for us, it was still a green light, I guess, if you will, green light for gold, green light for Bitcoin, green light for equities. And in more recent, that continued, really, as you got into the, probably I would say the August timeframe, you started to see the relative values there. You know, basically the Fed started not doing quite enough. And there's been some slack picked up by the U.S. banking system, you know, for all of the discussion about how weak overall lending has been. And that's true. If you look at the Fed's H.8 report in June and July, the last 2 months that have come out, overall lending is down 9% at an annualized rate, plus or minus, in each of those 2 months. A line item within there that continues, in my view, to not get enough press is the rate of growth of holdings of U.S. treasuries and agencies by the U.S. banking system. And in June, it grew at a 48% annual rate. In July, it rose at a 39% annual rate. And so overall, banks are not lending to the U.S. economy, but they are lending very robustly to the U.S. government. But even with that said, that robust banking system lending, it's still not been, quote unquote, enough in terms of the liquidity being supplied, it seems like. And so you've got this combination, Fed not doing enough. Some of that is also the U.S. fiscal side not doing enough, as we're seeing play out in Congress now in terms of the next round of stimulus. And so we've not seen. So we're long-winded way of saying we're into sort of this, I would call it almost a mini air pocket. We've seen, obviously, equity markets have sort of chopped a bit more and have been more volatile. And I think that that is a direct result of the lack of direction that we're seeing out of Washington as it relates to you know, the next round of stimulus and what the Fed's going to do, because ultimately the economy still, you know, while it's rebounded somewhat, a lot of that was fiscal and Fed aided, and it's not strong enough yet to stand on its own. So at this point, we still really like gold. Gold miners, they've kind of paused here for a bit as well with the chop we've seen in the equity market. But in terms of the longer run, nothing's changed. I continue to think that real interest rates in the United States are likely going to have to be much more negative than most people think for a much longer period of time than most people think.
It takes me back to that interview I saw with Lacey Hunt a month or so back with Grant Williams, and Bill Fleckenstein interviewed him. And he was talking about the Fisher equation. And he was talking about deflation. And if the Fed pegs the short end, let's say they peg Fed funds at zero, and if you do get deflation, then if you get more and more deflation, the real rates go up and up and up, which is kind of just this feedback loop where it makes lending tighter and tighter and tighter. So I know in your view, we're not getting deflation right now, and I don't think I would argue for that either. But how does that Fisher equation, or how do positive or negative real interest rates play into your outlook for the next 6 months or year?
So a lot of what is driving our view is just this context of in 2000, we had the stock bubble. It burst. It got kicked up to the banking system by creating a housing bubble. It burst. It got kicked up to the sovereign level by virtue of the bailouts. And so now we have a sovereign debt bubble globally. And for me, I try to just boil it down to the sovereigns, and in particular, the United States government cannot afford to pay positive real rates. They just can't. Once you get to the debt levels as high, when we're as financialized as we are, there's a number of different reasons that's the case. And so to me, we're in this back and forth of the Fed within all this. To me, it seems like the Fed wants to ride two horses with one rear end, and the horses are moving in opposite directions. And so they need to make their choice, and it's getting harder for them to try to sort of, you know, ride both of these horses at the same time. But they want, they want their negative real rates to stimulate the economy, but they also want their dollar reserve status to stay the same as it's been structured since 71. And they can't have both.
If they need to get real rates further negative, and that would require to take the Fed funds negative, A, how would they do that? And B, I've heard a lot of people talk about if the Fed takes interest rates negative, that's a lot different than the ECB or Japan doing it, especially if the 10-year were to go negative. So do you have views on that?
Absolutely. So I think it's very unlikely that the Fed will take rates negative ever. And the reason I think that is, I should be careful, ever is always a dangerous word, right? I think it's very unlikely that the Fed will take rates, nominal rates, negative, at least until the structure of the dollar's reserve status is changed. Then that could happen. But until that happens, I think it's very unlikely because them doing so would de facto amount to the end of the dollar reserve status as structured since 1971. I'm not saying the dollar would stop being the reserve per se, but what it would do would be you've got, call it $7 or $8 trillion in dollar denominated debt, treasuries basically, in FX reserves around the world globally. And so to the extent that those went negative in yield, now you're talking about their value, right? I mean, you're effectively, every new treasury you put in there, you're basically guaranteeing a loss. And my guess is in that case, you would see those $7 or $8 trillion bidding for gold, probably pretty aggressively. And you would the Fed would be basically de facto declaring gold to be the primary reserve asset of the world over the treasury bond. And there's reasons they might want to do that, but that's a political decision, I think, that probably falls outside their purview. And so to me, that's why I think that's unlikely. But I think if that happened, that's effectively what we'd see, is you'd effectively see gold replace the treasury bond as the world's primary reserve asset. That would probably be a good thing for the U.S. It'd be a good thing for the world. But again, that's a political decision.
How do you think rates on the going negative would impact the typical 60-40 risk parity portfolio that so many people have and so many financial advisors try to push people into? I had the conversation, I've heard Mike Green talk about it extensively. I know he's done a lot of research there, but I think his opinion is that would really blow up a lot of those risk parity accounts, because they're expecting their hedge to have a positive carry. And if the big hedge has a negative carry, then that's you're taking it into the no bueno zone.
Right. Yeah, it's not good. And you're already seeing signs of that. There have been a number of different articles about that in terms of what's next for the 40 side of that 60-40 for exactly the reason you cite. And it's interesting. They're looking for something new. And some of them are starting to turn to gold because for that exact reason, especially at a time when you start talking about things like higher inflation, possibly increasingly negative real rates, the bond side of that do not respond well. It's basically, once you get to the zero bound, it's either negative carry, some capital gain, but negative carry, or you're picking up nickels in front of a steamroller in terms of the convexity of the losses on the downside if you get to pick up an inflation on either a nominal or real basis. I don't think there's going to be big losses on a nominal side on bonds for a long time to come, but I think there's going to be substantial real losses. And so you're starting to see these bond portfolios dabble in gold because it's basically a 0% yielding bond of infinite duration and finite issuance. And it actually has a price that can rise a lot if inflation picks up, which bonds don't. And so we saw it a couple weeks ago in the Ohio Police and Firemen's Pension Fund here in Ohio, $16 billion pension allocated 5% to gold. That in and of itself to me was interesting. There've been a number of other articles. The thing about the Ohio story that was most interesting to me is they did it on the advice of their pension consultant, who's Wilshire Associates, who advises on $170 billion in pensions. And so to me, it seems like we might be on the cusp of exactly what you're describing, which is this 60-40 portfolio that's worked so well for so long, starting to break down on the fringes because of Fed interest rate and central bank interest rate policy. And it's starting to go into gold on the margin. And you know, I have to tell you, but if just 5% of the bond market tried to bid for the gold market, wow. Gold doesn't have the right digit in front of it. It might be a digit short of where it ends up going. I mean, it's a great, you know, gold as a percent of total global financial assets was 3-5 years ago, 50 basis points of world global financial assets. And so say it's doubled since then, global financial assets are probably up 30 or 50. So say it's 75 basis points of global financial. You try to cram 5% of the bond market into that, like, holy cow, it could be a rocket ship.
Yeah, I've talked to Rick about that several times. He always pulls up a stat, I think going back to the early 1980s, maybe the late 70s, where I'm probably not going to get this right, but maybe 8% of assets were allocated to gold. And recently it was maybe 1%, something like that. So he's saying, you know, we don't even have to go back up to the 8%, but if we just went up to 2 or 3%, you would see gold up at maybe $5,000 an ounce. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it was something like that. Just out of curiosity, that pension fund that you were referring to, how did they place the bet? Did they buy physical or did they buy GLD or what did they do?
I don't know how they structured. I think it's just starting now in terms of the asset allocation decision or the execution. The allocation decision has been made, but the execution, I'm not sure, has been made yet. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. How that's played out. That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, I'll be watching that for sure, because that's really a big deal if a lot of these pension funds, especially if you get kind of if we see CPI starting to creep up and kind of confirm that those inflation fears, and they, you know, more and more go into that, that could be huge capital flows. So, okay, I want to get your opinion on this interview I did with Jeff and Lynn the other day. And it really opened my eyes on several different fronts. But one thing that one of my main takeaways from the interview was Jeff talking about how the economy really can't recover in a healthy way unless the euro dollar system is either fixed or replaced by something else. And I know prior to recording, you and I were talking about that discussion and you're giving me your views. And I said, whoa, stop, Luke, don't say anything else. Let's wait for the interview. So do you want to expand on that a bit?
Yeah, I think I thought it was a tremendous interview. So first off, kudos. I thought you did a great job, and you let them kind of talk it through and just guided the conversation really well. So it was an excellent interview. I agreed with a lot of what both of them said. You know, I wouldn't even say, for me, the one thing I do disagree with is that the Fed doesn't know that this is a problem, the way that it's struck. I don't think it is. I don't think the neglect is as benign as you know, the benign neglect point he made. I don't think it's benign neglect at all. I think it's intentional neglect, or it's maybe more apropos, you know, it's difficult to get a man to see something when his salary is dependent upon his not seeing it. And by that, I mean, there was a great interview, two great interviews, actually, by Bernard Leterre, who recently passed, and he's a great monetary theorist, former central banker. Two of them. So number one, and you can find these on YouTube. You can Google Bernard Leterre, Never Touch the Money System. Okay. And there's about a 45-second clip of him in a lecture. And he says, you know, Paul Krugman, he said, Paul Krugman and I both were at MIT together. And he told me, didn't they tell you never touch the money system? Never touch the money system. You can touch everything else around, but you can never touch the money system. And the reason why is if you touch the money system or try to, you won't get invited to all the right places and all the academic awards and all these things. And so that to me suggests, number one, that they know not to, you know, that what Jeff's recommending is absolutely the right prescription. The problem is the money system. The issue is not that the Fed doesn't know it's not a problem. It's that they know they can't get invited to the right parties or get the right academic awards if they try to touch the money system, because that's political. That's something decided not in their purview, or at least they need other people's permission to do that. Same Bernard Leterre said, I went to the BIS said, hey, we should change this and that because the system will work a lot better. And they said, oh, Bernard, didn't they tell you? Our job is not to change anything. Our job is to defend the current system down to its last dying drop. Like, and he said, okay, that's fine. I promptly resigned and went and did other things, because if I can't affect positive change in the way the system needs to be changed, then there's no point in me being here, is basically the gist of this. And you can find that one on YouTube. And so I think they know. I think ultimately the issue is it's a political decision, right? So when you talk to, you go to Washington, I think in Washington, there's now two groups. And I think for a long period of time, you know, you guys touched on this in the interview, was the dollar denominated reserve system as structured post 71 that, you know, was built around the petrodollar, and then the euro dollar system sprung up. I think that there were reasons that happened and was allowed to develop. Namely, we needed to win the Cold War, and allowing those systems to grow and flourish the way they did was advantageous to us winning the Cold War. After we won the Cold War, what should have been done was some sort of monetary conference where they sit down and they restructure things in a way that is more sustainable, better balanced, however you want to talk about it. We didn't do that, of course. We basically pressed our advantage as a unilateral power. And this is a key, you know, the dollar and the euro dollar system were key proponents, components of that unilateral power. And even then, I would say it was probably on net a positive for the U.S.
I'm thinking of Triffin's paradox. And do you think because the euro dollar system, and Snyder takes it all the way back to Bretton Woods, and do you think that because the euro dollar system was able to create these dollars that the world needed to grow without the U.S. having to print and export them, for lack of a better term, do you think that was beneficial to the United States because we didn't have to create more and more of these currency units, or the Fed maybe didn't have to create more of the units domestically, that there was something outside of the United States that could create those dollars for the world to grow? Or am I overthinking it?
No, I think partially it was a regulatory arbitrage. Some of it was, and I think Jeff has talked to that in some of his work on the euro dollar. But I think it was quickly understood, if not in the Fed, then in the halls of power in Washington, what this was effectively doing. That basically this was giving them control of the world through the dollar. It was, an American empire constructed through the dollar. And I think that was understood very well. And it's not something the economists talk about in polite company. And I think that's why they're not allowed to change the money system. Because when you talk about changing the money system, you're talking about changing it's geopolitical. We're not in economics anymore. We're now in geopolitics and political economy. And so to tie it back to those two groups, I think there is this group in Washington that still thinks this is a great deal and it works for them. And, you know, we can see why they would think that, because it's been very, very good for their standard of living. However, there's another group in Washington centered around the defense and certain parts of the intelligence apparatus that are have gotten increasingly vocal in the last, call it 3 to 5 years, about how dangerous this system actually is for America around the ability for America to defend and compete in the world, which is to say, if China is our primary adversary, with both, which both groups agree upon, by the way, both, I'm going to call these people over here sort of the neocons, right? They're, you know, just sort of the status quo Washington, dollar's good for us. We can beat everybody over the head with a dollar, and China's our adversary.
Okay.
So that's this group. And then this group, the sort of, you know, there's a great line by a Marine, former Marine general, Barrow, I believe his last name is. And he said, amateurs study tactics, but professionals study logistics. These are the guys studying logistics for a living. And they're going, great, we agree that China is the adversary. Do you guys understand that the currency system that you think is so great guarantees that we can't fight and win a war against China because we are dependent upon them for our supply chains? And these people go, well, we'll just move a little bit to India and we'll move a little bit to Mexico and it'll all be good. And these guys are going, no, you don't understand. They're a serious power. The first thing we did after World War II was not ship all our factories to the Soviet Union to save 40% on labor. For this reason, they were our adversary. And they go, well, maybe. And I think there's these two groups that, and the second group has been gaining more leeway. And I think COVID has finally pushed a lot of people that were on the fence over into their camp in the last 6 months, because it was easy for the first group to say, well, you know, maybe it's, you know, but the Chinese would never do that. And then COVID happened and we said, hey, we need face masks. And the Chinese go, yeah, right after we do it, right after we take care of ourselves. And then somebody else pointed out astutely. Then some people pointing this out astutely for years. 80% of our antibiotic supply either comes from or touches China in some way. Mm-hmm. That's this. So there's these two groups, they're battling. The second group is gaining momentum for de facto obvious reasons. It's just, you're seeing the world develop in that way. But I think when you say, does the Fed know? I think they know. But I think, you know, if they ever said, hey, we could fix this by changing the currency system, they go over to the people making policy in Washington and they say, don't touch the money system. You know, we'll find someone else to do your job. Don't touch the money system. And that's been the conversation, I think, for 50 years. And that conversation, I think, is changing because of what we just described in terms of what the Defense Department has been saying in terms of COVID, in terms of China being reclassified. As instead of being a supporter of the dollar system, as being somebody who is, you know, trying to revive a revisionist power, we've called them, you know, they were in great power competition with them. So that system, I think, is changing, but it's a political change that has to happen both abroad, but then domestically. If I'm the Fed, if I'm if I work with Treasury, I could have inflation next week. It's very easy to do.
You're talking about inflation in the U.S.
CPI. I could get CPI. What number you want? I can have it for you in 2 months.
How would you do that?
You have to marry Treasury and the Fed. That has to be political. So in other words, Treasury has to decide, okay, too much of our semiconductor supply chain is in Taiwan. It's dangerous. China could overrun it easily. They know we can't defend it. We know we can't defend it. Okay, bring some of it back. How do we do that? And we do the, you know, if you saw a couple months ago, Kodak, right? Trump invoked the National Defense Production Act in March, quietly. You read the National Defense Production Act, it gives the executive great latitude to basically do whatever he wants and submit the bill to the Fed. Mm. And full caveat, I'm not a lawyer. So I've read it. It seems to be very clear on this. We saw symptoms of this with the Kodak deal, right? Under the National Defense Production Act, Trump gave $700 million to Kodak to come up with some chemicals on, you know, for COVID. So in theory, with the National Defense Production Act invoked, you could see Trump, you know, you could see the executive or Congress, the policy side, the fiscal side say, we want more chip production in the U.S. We're going to give Intel $100 billion in interest-free loans to build fabs and tax credits to build 10 fabs in the next 2 years. And then we're going to give $200 billion more to, the infrastructure segment. And we are going to massively upgrade our, and we're going to, you know, we're going to spend $1 trillion on education. And we're also going to forgive $1.5 trillion in student loans tomorrow. And we're going to, and people are going to say, well, who's going to buy the treasuries? And the answer would be the Fed. Fed's going to buy treasuries. Well, interest rates are going to go up. Nope. Interest rates are going to be where the Fed says they are because they have a printing press. And so if this 10 years at 70 basis points, the Fed will buy however many 10 years as it takes for it to be. So if we did that for 2 months, I assure you inflation would be whatever number I could get you. And what we're talking about here, of course, is de facto MMT. This is modern monetary. But this, again, this is a change in the currency system. You can't do this and have the U.S. Treasury bond be the primary reserve asset of the world. That system where that we've seen since 71, you know, pre 71, it was dollar global reserve, gold primary reserve asset. Mm-hmm. Post 71, it's dollar global reserve currency, treasury bond primary reserve asset. This system, this MMT, eliminates the treasury bond as global reserve asset. You can't have that be your, if you're a foreign creditor of the United States, you can't store the wealth of your country in a treasury bond where you've got Trump saying, hey, Intel, take $100 billion. Hey, infrastructure, take $200 billion. Hey, Kodak, take $1 billion. Hey, and Fed's just going to buy it all with printed money.
If you own long-dated dollar, they're creating so many more dollars.
And it's being spent into the real economy. And it's being spent into the real economy. That's the key too, right? This is the, you're basically having the U.S. run a China model. It's basically a modern monetary theory model. And this would be enormously positive for the U.S. It would be enormously positive for labor rates. It'd be enormously positive for GDP, global growth. It would not be enormously positive for the dollar. It would not be positive for those that have benefited most from the treasury export business, right? So Wall Street, Washington, they love having that treasury bond be the primary reserve asset of the world. It gives them power. But it's also killing the United States now. That system is now, that's that the reason why we've hollowed out our manufacturing is we made a choice that the treasury bond would be the primary reserve asset of the world. As long as that's the case, that when you hear Jeff Snyder say they're you know, there's this problem, something's not happening. The something that's not happening is the chosen structure of the money system, that the treasury bond is the primary reserve asset of the world is the problem. Get rid of that. And a lot of the problems that Jeff highlights in terms of the transmission mechanisms, et cetera, go away. It's not good for the dollar. It changes the money system. And that's where I get into this. It's a political fight.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit. You were talking about the Fed just buying the treasuries. And when you were saying that, I could hear Brent in the back of my head saying, okay, Luke, well, how are they buying the treasuries? Because he's going to, and I don't want to put word in Brent, and for those of the viewers who aren't following me, Brent Johnson, a good buddy of both of ours, who's really a dollar bull, I guess. And he's pointed out many times on Twitter, especially, that the primary dealer banks are buying those treasuries at auction. And if they're buying them with cash, then that's taking liquidity out of the system. And therefore, if they had to buy all those, call it, you know, $10 trillion or whatever in treasuries, and that's actually taking liquidity out of the system to buy those treasuries, and it's just being replaced with bank reserves, which really can't do anything. So are you saying that the Fed would buy those newly created treasuries with actual bank reserves, or how are you seeing kind of the minutia there?
So the minutia is really twofold, I would say. First is, you know, when you listen to what Jeff Snyder was saying in his interview, he said the primary dealers, they create the money out of thin air to buy at the auction. They create the money, keystroke, buy. And then if I remember hearing him right, it's they credit a government account against, right, there's, they have the flexibility.
TGA is with the Fed.
So. Right. So they can do it that way. They can create the money out of thin air. That's minutia number one. But minutia number two that I think is really important is Brent was correct functionally up until April of this year, when the Fed changed the SLR, supplementary leverage ratio, calculations for the U.S. banking system as it relates to the treasury bonds, treasury bond market. And what that said was, so supplementary leverage ratio was effectively would have been the functional restriction on what Brent's describing, what you just laid out, which is, okay, if the Fed's going to buy all those bonds, the SLR would have said they could only buy so many of those, and then they were, you know, breaching regulatory capital thresholds, and that would have forced them to constrain other lending in other parts or sell off other assets and crowded out the dollar market, and dollar goes up, risk goes down.
The commercial banking system.
The commercial banks, you the whole commercial banking system. Now, however, the Fed specifically exempted treasuries from the SLR calculations, which means that the for Jeff Snyder, they can buy treasuries out of thin air, right? They create the money out of thin air to bid at auction. And if they have to put them on their balance sheet, they don't count against any regulatory capital effectively. So basically, they could buy a quadrillion treasuries and they don't have to have a single ounce of capital against it under this SLR rule. And that's an exaggeration taken to, you know, but the point is that I think they will eventually at some point hit some sort of regulatory issue. But what this SLR rule change did was monumental. It basically meant that the problems we had in late 18 and the problems we had again in summer of 19 in terms of the banking system running out of balance sheet to buy treasuries. And so it led them selling off other stuff, dollar up, risk off. That constraint got removed in April. Mm-hmm. And so these primary dealer, they can buy whatever they want, put it on their books. If they're accounted for in however the regulation says, there's no accounting capital charge. So quietly, to me, when you look at the setup of these pieces, whether you look at the National Defense Production Act signed by Trump on the fiscal side, when you look at the SLR suspension as it relates to treasuries from the Fed in April, to me, it looks like you are positioning the U.S. banking system to basically engage in QE forever as the Fed's proxy. And that you could do that through, you could do what I just described in terms of the fiscal side with the banks taking it on in this manner. It remains yet to be seen if the fiscal guys can, you know, fiscal authorities can actually get the ball over the goal line, but the pieces are in place.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
When we get done, remind me, I've got to get the whatever articles you have on that. I'd love to read those and turn that into a whiteboard video. So
sure.
How does the TGA play into that? I've been traveling the last couple of weeks, like I said, so I'd really have been out of the kind of the macro loop, if you will. And I know the TGA was up about 1.7 trillion. And I know we're getting close to the election. And are they spending that down? And if not, do you think they are going to spend it down? Or do you think it's just maybe they're piling all those, just kind of the dry powder in case we get a second round of COVID? Or what do you think is going on with the TGA?
Yeah, I've not looked at it in a few weeks. I mean, it hit almost 1.8, I think, at peak. And I think, like you said, it's backed off a bit. But what I've read on it has been either A, it's basically funding for stuff that's already been promised, and so they're going to backfill with that. In that case, that's not really stimulative, of course. That's just backfilling stimulus that's already happened.
But it's still creating additional deposits. Even if it's earmarked, if it hasn't been spent, once it's spent, you know, that's going to increase deposits or liabilities of the commercial banking system. That's going to be technically more currency units chasing the same amount of goods and services.
And yes, you would think so. Yeah. And so I would have thought they would have started to spend it down more aggressively. Maybe it's the rainy day fund for, you know, the hedge, you know, basically saying, you know, maybe they were smart about it. I mean, you can make a case that they looked ahead and said, you know what, if they're going to get us out of office, a good way they can get us out of office is by holding up the second round of stimulus and crashing the market. And if we have this giant war chest, that takes away the ability for them to threaten, they being the other side of the aisle. They can't threaten us. Yeah, maybe. I'm just purely speculating at this point. But it's if I was very Machiavellian about it, that's what I would do, is just say, hey, listen, you got to get something done. And you know, no matter what, you're not going to get me out of office, because I'll just run this $1.8 trillion down to $800 billion and, you know, $100 billion or $1 trillion more in 6 weeks. No one's going to notice that you guys are, you know, messing around. And by that time, the economy's humming, the election's over. If we've won, then, you know, all of that was for naught. So maybe that's what's going on. But I've been a little surprised that it hasn't been worked down more.
Let's go into the dollar. And I haven't been following the DXY. I know it was down, like, last time I checked, 92, I think, something like that. And it kind of paused there, was chopping around. So what has it done? I know you're following that probably daily, I'm sure. And where do you see it going in the next 6 months, the next year? I mean, how does the TGA and everything that we've talked about in this interview so far play into that dollar thesis?
Yeah, so to me, so it's the easy part of the answer is it's today was back under 93. It popped over 93 earlier in the late last week. I think, you know, maybe it got to 93.40 or 93.50, something like that. And it's, you know, 92.90 or 92.98 or something today. So it's still chopping there, maybe a little bit more. It seems to have moved on some technical levels where it could make a run higher. And certainly the air pocket we've seen in equities, and then this non-action in terms of the second round of stimulus or third round, whatever we're on now, is all else equal supportive for the dollar. So that's the first thing I'm watching. The longer picture, you know, if you really look at what I think it really comes down to what the fiscal side does. And some of that is election driven, right? Where if the fiscal authorities do enough, and I think they're going to have to do enough, then I think it's you're basically into this. I think you're basically into this. It's going to head lower. And I think that's still my base case, because, again, because COVID blew such a hole on the in the fiscal side, the U.S. government needs negative real rates for an extended period of time.
Right.
And so ultimately, that to me is going to be negative for the dollar. That's, you know,
when you talk about the dollar going down, do you see it going back down to like 70 where it was in, what was that, 2010, 2011? Or do you see it getting down into 50 or really going below that? Because I know, you know, everyone knows you as the dollar bear, but what does that mean as far as how it relates to the DXY?
I think it's going lower, because when you look at the deficit side, what COVID did put us in an irrevocable position, really. And by that, I mean, so another thing I've not seen a lot of press on has been that the, you know, in the most recent year-to-date data, or the second most recent, excuse me, through June, the U.S. Spending on what we call the true interest expense, right? So it's not just interest expense. It is interest expense, and it's the pay-as-you-go portion of entitlements, healthcare, Medicare, Social Security, et cetera, veterans benefits. The punchline is we lump the pay-as-you-go portions in as debt, because at the end of the day, there's no difference functionally between the U.S. Treasury sending you or my mother a check for Treasury-bound holdings, or you or my mother a check for her Medicare or Social Security. It's the same dollar obligations that they are making good on. So we look at the pay-as-you-go portion as the interest portion of this gigantic entitlement obligation. And when you look at interest expense plus the pay-as-you-go portion, in June, year-to-date, it was over 100% of the expenditure on the interest, right? So interest plus pay as you go. Effective interest was 106% of tax receipts. So we're spending over 100% of tax receipts just floating the obligations we have. So we're having to print money just to pay interest. And I've had a couple different investing graybeards tell me, look, it's you don't have fiscal sovereign. Sovereigns don't have fiscal problems until they have to print the interest to print the money to pay the interest. And the point is the U.S. is there now. We're there. COVID, I didn't think we would be there till mid to late 2022, maybe early 2023 when I first started modeling it back in 2018. But COVID blew such a hole in the economy, in the receipt side, that and the countervailing stimulus on the spending side, we're now there. So when I look at that, I say, okay, we're going to have to print the money to pay the interest. That's going to continue. The banking system has been brought in as an ally to basically do QE forever, you know, as Fed proxy. And so, you know, in terms of where that, I've not modeled that out to where that goes in a DXY in the near term. But, you know, I think if it breaks, I don't know, I saw someone there, if it breaks 92 or 91, breaks 91, you know, it could go to 85 pretty quickly. You know, and those are the types of things, the ways I look at it. And so, yeah, I would think, again, if all of this is the caveat to all of this is critical, which is if we don't have an air pocket in terms of what the government and the Fed do, right? If, you know, in the same way that I could get you, you know, whatever in CPI inflation number you want in 2 months, I can get you whatever Dixie number you want quicker than that, you know, is if you shut down Congress, have them not spend money and have the Fed say, we're going to go from $80 billion a month to zero, or we're going to taper. Yeah, Dixie's probably 120, 130 in a big darn hurry. S&P's probably 1500, you know, in a big darn hurry, which then has problems because the economy's based on it. So you would go into a deflationary death spiral at that point, basically, for the economy, for the global economy. You know, the world would be selling the $40 trillion in dollar-denominated assets they have very aggressively, and the only buyer would be the Fed. So they would have to decide if they wanted, you know, asset prices to basically get fire sold down to virtually nothing, or when they wanted to step in. So it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I think it's important to give both sides of what that is. And so it really here too, it's kind of a political decision. You know, where do we want the dollar, and what they have levers to make the dollar do, you know, what they want it to do in the short run. But ultimately, fiscal situation is now irrecoverable, really, in terms of that printing the interest just to, you know, just printing the money just to pay the interest. That's a problem, and that's not good for the dollars in the structurally.
So when you're saying they're printing the money, they're at the point right now where they've got to print the money to pay the interest. The last time, this was pre-COVID, I know their interest payments were maybe 400, 500 billion, and the tax receipts were, let's call it 3 trillion. Mm-hmm. So now you're saying because tax receipts have gone down so much and that the spending with COVID has gone up this year, I think we're going to be running probably a $5 trillion deficit, which is insane when you think that I think our total debt from 1776 to 2000 was roughly the same amount as our deficit just this year.
Yeah, that might be right. Yeah, that's, well, I don't think it was $5 trillion this year, but I think spending this year might be $5 trillion, right? So the deficit's probably, they're probably close to three, maybe 2.5, something like that. But yeah, it's it's a combination of those factors. And again, some of it is just the structurals. I think it's more tax receipt driven, really, in terms of.
So basically, when GDP goes down by 50%, so the tax receipts probably go down by even more.
Yeah, it's trying to think if it's quite one for one. You know, the before tax receipts were running at about 3.3 trillion annually, and we were spending 4.2, 4.3, something like that. And I think we've ramped up the spending a bit. But again, for me, I'm leaving all that extra stuff out. I'm just looking at Social Security, healthcare, Medicare. And this is the net interest number. I could gross interest would probably take it with the, you know, the $500 billion a year would take it probably to 110% of 110% of tax receipts. These debt-like instruments that we have, these debt-like obligations that we have, just to keep them good, just to keep the money good, is 106% of tax receipts. And so it's mostly the tax receipt hit. So on one hand, the good news is if the economy does a V recovery, you can get back to that, you know, pre-existing, you know, 1 trillion per year we were running at. The challenge is that it's not looking like that's happening, or nor does it look like that's likely to happen anytime soon.
No way, Luke. There's no way. And I entertained that idea prior to coming back to the United States, like when I was in St. Bart's.
Okay.
By the way, Hugh says hi, I'm sure.
Tell him I said hello.
But anyway, I was kind of entertaining that. But now that I've been back, especially here in Vegas, I mean, there's no way. I've been going out the last few nights to dinner and whatnot. Vegas is running at 30% capacity. I mean, I don't see how they come out the other end, they meaning the entire town. I mean, I just don't see how it happens. So sure, the stock market can have a V-shaped recovery, but I just don't think there's any way. Obviously, the probability is greater than zero, but I don't think it's got a very good shot at all. I would be shocked if the economy has a V-shaped recovery.
Yeah, you understand that, Biz. I mean, 30% capacity utilization, you're bleeding cash in those types of businesses. You just are.
Yeah, in almost every type of business.
That's a great point. Almost every business.
Yeah.
So you've got debt.
If you've got a normal business, and I was an entrepreneur for many years, if you've got one that's running at a 10 or 15% margin, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, most of these businesses around here, like the restaurants and whatnot that I see in the casinos that are maybe 50% capacity, they're running at a 5% margin.
Yeah, it's a tough business.
Yeah, super, super thin. So I just don't see how it plays out. And California is the problems that they're having are just substantial. And that kind of transitions into the next thing that I wanted to talk about. Because I always hear you talk about macro and the dollar and the Fed and all these things. But I'd really like to get your opinion on kind of the future of social unrest in the United States. And what I've been thinking about is, of course, the election. And if Trump wins, and you know, I'm not here to say he's bad or good, or I dislike both parties equally, but I'm just trying to think through how that would work if he wins from the social unrest. Are we going to see riots, more looting? And then another thing that I was thinking about was if the police officers that were involved with the George Floyd incident, if they were to somehow be acquitted, and I'm not saying that they should or they shouldn't, that's not what this conversation is about. I'm just trying to think through kind of the knock-on effects from a macroeconomic standpoint, if that were to happen, from a standpoint of social unrest. Have you given that any thought?
Yes, a little bit. I there was a great tweet today by Chris Cole highlighting, you know, something. So there was a Bloomberg article a couple of weeks ago. We highlighted it in our research that the amount of VIX futures volume around the election, I think, is setting records. So what that tells you in plain English is there's a whole bunch of betting going on, or positioning, hedging, whatever you want to call it, around the U.S. election.
Yeah.
But Chris Cole, who has forgotten more about volatility and derivatives than I'll ever know, had this great tweet today saying, yes, there's a whole lot of positioning around the the election. But if you look beyond the election, there's very little. And so there's not much betting or belief or hedging going on around the risk of a contested election or extended social unrest or any of these types of things. So I thought that that was interesting, number one. The other way I've been thinking about it, too, has been, and this ties into some of what Jeff and Lynn were talking about with you last week, which was we had a point in one of our another one of our recent pieces, which showed, and I forget whose data it was, but it was a great chart. It showed in 1985, I think it was the median U.S. household income. You needed to have 20, you needed to spend 20% of that income to get your essentials, right? So shelter, food, healthcare, education, you know, maybe a vacation, you know, sort of the basics of sort of middle-class family life. He's all right, well, 20%. You had to work for 20 weeks at the median income to get those things. So 20 weeks, 52 weeks a year, not bad. Fast forward to 2018, you now need 53 weeks at the median income to get those same things. Problem being, there's only 52 weeks in a year, of course. And so to me, a way, and I don't want to downplay the social injustice side of what has happened. There are issues as a country that we need to work through. What I'm saying is I think those social injustice issues were merely the spark that touched off an absolute tinderbox of frustration around a bunch of people that played by the rules. They went to college and they took out the loans and they did everything they were supposed to do. And they wake up in 2018 and find that they have to work 53 weeks a year just to have the American dream. And that, I think, is a much bigger, I think it's a much bigger issue than is being led on. As you know, the narrative is all, it's all about social justice. I think social justice is part of it, but I think the frustration, the anger, and the fact that these things are able to burn as long as they've been burning, right? I mean, this is not just a couple protests for a week. This is, you know, Portland's been going for 90, 95, 100 days or something. Right. And I think the reason it's been lasting that long is because the issues are much more endemic beyond the social justice thing. The frustration, the real fuel to this is this frustration of, I have to work 53 weeks to afford those things that used to, you know, once upon a time, 30 years ago, I could work 20 weeks for. And so it also ties into the point of, hey, there's no CPI inflation. Yes, other than food, shelter, healthcare, education, and vacation prices, no, there's not been. Well, those also happen to be the only, you know, the things that really matter to the average person.
And people notice them.
That's exactly right. They notice them. They notice them. So it's, And the challenge in it, to address your question directly of how much longer could this type of unrest last, the disheartening thing is that the fix to this is changing the money system. This is a symptom of the money system problem. And it goes right back to the beginning, right? The Fed, I think, is acutely aware of this. You know, it's interesting. They say we're not causing wealth inequality. Technically, they're right. They're not. The money system's causing it, and they're just defending the money system. And so, you know, it's this cognitive dissonance. You can see the cognitive dissonance in their brain to some extent. And so that, to me, is disconcerting. Because if you fix the money system, you could see clear to a way where wages would rise. You know, basically, you can see it in the charts. The labor share of profits in the economy are at 50, 60, 70-year lows. If you change that you have to change the money system to change that. If you did that, you could have the Fed pegging mortgages for a few years. You could have wages rising at 10 or 15% a year. Sorry, mortgage holders, you know, you lose. Well, the Fed owns a third of the mortgages anyway. Who cares? You know, have them buy all the mortgages. It doesn't matter. The issue is the people that have benefited from that treasury bond being the primary reserve asset. They don't want to let go of that sweet, sweet cherry, even though it's not, you know, it's killing them. It's, you know, they want to say, we want to, you know, we're going to beat China and we're going to keep this dollar system. And those two things are increasingly mutually exclusive. So if you fix the currency system, you could, I think, really calm the unrest, because then you start looking at, you know, the cost of, you know, the go forward cost of some of these healthcare, you know, education. You start buying room for people within that budget, right? I mean, the government could come out and say everyone goes to college for free forever, right there. And you could probably take that 53 weeks back down to 48 weeks. You buy room, you buy breathing room. There's no reason that we can't do that. None. You know, it's not like Congress said, well, we need to go find the money first. We need to go borrow a bunch of money from a bunch of students before we send those students to go fight in Iraq. They didn't say that. They just said, we're going to Iraq, and whatever the cost is, and away we'll go. And if you did the same thing for education, you could buy room for the system. But again, that is changing the money system. That's a political question that, you know, may play into the election.
Because the Fed would, that debt.
Fed would basically, yeah, you'd be basically creating currency. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's very, very insightful. And I think you've done, and I know we're limited on time here, Luke, so this will kind of wrap it up here. But I know you've done a lot more research than anyone I know on how dependent the economy is right now as far as consumption on asset prices. And so when you were talking earlier about the S&P going back down to 1500 and staying there and not just having a V-shaped recovery in the S&P, I started to think about what Mike Green has been talking about with passive. And I'm sure you've heard and read some of his stuff where, you know, their only decision-making process, these fund managers, is if a dollar comes in, then you buy, and if a dollar goes out, you sell. And I'm just, and it's, you know, you've got so many of these baby boomers that are in this this passive scheme, and I'm thinking, man, if the S&P goes down to 1500 and stays there consistently, you know, people get more and more afraid, and these are people who are invested in these passive funds. So you have net outflows of passive while at the same time the stock market's going down. Where does that take us on the S&P, and then what does that do to consumption?
It's very pro-cyclical, I mean, and it's a great point, right? So the work we've done, as I'm sure people have heard me say before, is if you look at the IRS data, net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions are about 200% of the annual growth in personal consumption expenditures, or PCE. And PCE is, call it, two-thirds of U.S. GDP. It's a huge number. It's like $14 trillion. And it's broad. And so it's not to say that people are taking a dollar out of their, you know, a capital gain or their IRA per se and buying a boat or a car, a house or healthcare. PCE is a very broad category. But what it is saying is that it's mathematically near impossible for the U.S. PCE to grow if you aren't generating capital gains and taxable IRA distributions on a go-forward base. So in other words, if the market crashes and stays down on some lag, and it's not that long a lag, but on some lag, you're going to start seeing PCE decline. And once PCE declines, because it's two-thirds of GDP, GDP declines. And the problem with a GDP decline when you're a nation with 100%+ debt to GDP is your interest rates are rising and your GDP is shrinking. You're now into a debt death spiral if you let that go for very long at all. And so,
did your research equities include real estate as well?
That's an all-in net capital gains number. So my guess is that is a little bit of both, along with sort of business sales and what have you, depending on how the real estate is accounted for. So it's a broad asset inflation dynamic, basically, is how I've always thought of it.
Okay.
Just with S&P as a proxy, basically, right? Because generally speaking, if the S&P's fallen, all asset prices are falling. It's they've become very pro-cyclical in recent years. So to answer your question, in terms of if you have the S&P fall and stay down, yeah, you're going to see this absolute deflationary death spiral for as long as the Fed stands aside, because everyone's going to be scrambling for dollars. Dollar's going to go up. Passive mom and pop are going to be selling, so there's more selling. foreigners own $40 trillion gross of dollar-denominated assets, $11 trillion net. And so you're going to have $40 trillion all up for sale, possibly up to $40 trillion up for sale from foreigners looking to raise dollars. And so you've got all that selling, and it's all on one side of the table, and there's nobody on the other side. There's no bids.
Do you think the Fed would have to buy stocks?
I think they really don't want to do that. So if they don't want to do that, they have to nip every single one of these sell-offs in the bud in terms of supplying liquidity into the bond market, whether that's treasuries, mortgages, and in this latest round, corporates, junk, whatever it takes. Because, yeah, otherwise, in extremis, if the Fed just does nothing, you'll see the S&P go, you know, staggeringly low, surprisingly fast, because the numbers, the leverage is so big, the dollar shortage is so big, the net international investment position of the U.S. is so negative. In other words, there's so much dollar assets, you know, and that's, you know, part of my disagreement with Brent about our views on the dollar is that the dollar milkshake, he's right, but it's already happened. That the reason why foreigners own $40 trillion in gross in U.S. dollar denominated assets is because those dollars are all already here. And so if they're short dollars, if the dollar rises and the Fed doesn't do enough, there is no equity. It's not that the money will flow here into equities at some point. The equity position, as you know, the whole system's levered. When the whole system's levered and it crashes, the equity position goes to zero. There is no equity. And that's what would happen here, where the equity tranche, the equity market, would evaporate, because capital structure 101 says the bondholders own all the companies, and then they take a loss. And, you know, so you basically, again, it's been constructed this way, or it's evolved this way. I thought Lynn and Jeff did a really nice job, and that was a great question on your part in terms of, I think they wanted this system when it started, and I think they saw the way in which it was evolving, and they saw how it helped them in the near term for their geopolitical goals. And then it just sort of took on a life of its own. But where it's reached now is that literally they can't sustain a sell-off for very long, because if they do, it touches off all this, you know, everybody selling and nobody buying. And that's a problem, because then, to your point, the translation is GDP, you know, PCE goes to from 14 trillion to, I don't know, 7 trillion, gets cut in half. And now tax receipts get, you know, GDP gets cut in half and stays down. And now all of a sudden, and that's why I always say, and people laugh at me a lot when I say, listen, if the Fed stands aside and doesn't do anything, that they'll default on treasuries or entitlements or both, is you take tax receipts down by half. And now you're, and it's really not even half, but it's just for a thought exercise, take it down by half. You go, whatever, $1.7 trillion, spending's 4.3, 2.6, maybe you do some countercyclical, right? So say you're running a $3.3 trillion deficit. Who buys that? The Fed's not doing anything. Guess what happens? Interest rates start rising. There's 3.3 for sale. No buyers. They're all selling.
Right.
And so now rates are rising. And so you know how much of the U.S. market's real estate. Okay, now everybody's house is falling too. So it's all geared in one way.
Yeah, and one great thing you always point out is that they're rolling over like $10 trillion a year.
Oh, it's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And I haven't looked at the TBAC report recently to see what the number is, but it's gotten a lot bigger. And a lot of it's all short term. That's the other thing is, you know, last year we were talking about the number. It was 10 trillion with 70% of it, you know, 12 months or less. And so you're always rolling over more and more and more. That's what you'd be looking at. And that's, you know, I think the Fed understands this. And I think they understand it's a whole heck of a lot easier to just, you know, listen to everybody make fun of them for the Fed put in the equity market than to sort of stand aside and, you know, teach everybody the lesson that, you know, some people think they want everybody to learn. I'm not sure we all want to learn that. That lesson.
Yeah, it's, and therefore the release valve is the dollar.
Has to be.
Yeah. So, Luke, I appreciate your time. Let's go into what you're doing. We've got an awesome promotion going on right now. I think it lasts through the next Sunday, if I'm not correct. So we'll have an affiliate link to Tree Rings down in the description below, and I'll my editor throw it up there. I'm obviously a big fan of yours. I love to promote your product. So can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on with that promotion?
Absolutely. So Tree Rings is a product of ours. It's very popular. It comes out as a 10 most interesting things that we've read in any particular week. But what it really is, and it has a synopsis of each point, but it's really about aggregating on an ongoing basis the signposts of things we're seeing and relative to some of the broader trends we're talking about, writing about, et cetera. So if you like the content we put out, it's a great piece. It is at a very attractive retail price point, and it is all about highlighting these signposts. And it's not a confirmation bias signposts. It's not all about, hey, here's another sign that we think the dollar's weakening, and here's another sign. It's about being objective. Hey, this signpost happened, and listen, this could mean that a big change in our thesis, but we've got to see some more. Or this could mean the dollar could rise in the short run. Or this could mean, hey, this is bad for the euro. This is good for gold, bad for gold. Just trying to really help build these signposts and this framework in our client's mind so that they can feel increased confidence with everything going on in the world, as crazy as it is. And so it's really just about assembling for our clients every week an ongoing tally of these signposts. So it's been really popular, and so we're really excited to promote it. And it's basically, the promotion is about getting people in, getting people on board with it, start to receive the product. If they sign up by Sunday, they get 4 free weeks and some other great access as well.
I got a list of all the bonuses right here that your digital marketing gal sent over. You get 4 free weeks. Yep. You get access to the back issues of Tree Rings. You get the top 20 books that you guys suggest. You get past webinars, which I think would be awesome. And then also you get that price locked in for however long you want to stay a subscriber. And this is a retail product, correct?
Correct. Yeah, okay. It's a retail product. Yep.
For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, Luke, where can they follow you? I know Twitter, of course, but what's your Twitter handle and what's your web address?
You bet. So Twitter, I'm at Luke Groman, LukeGroMen. And then my web address is fftt-llc.com. That's frank-tom-tom-llc.com.
Okay, awesome. Thanks for your time, Luke. I can't wait to do it again.
All right. Thanks, George. You too. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.